Jonah chapter 1. Verses 1 and 2 is our text. It says, "Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah the son of Amittai, saying, Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness is come up before me." Keep your Bible open to Jonah chapter 1. Thank you. You may be seated. It's interesting to notice that the first word that God spoke to Jonah was the word arise. And that command is given three times to Jonah. Jonah chapter 1 verse 2, Jonah chapter 1 verse 6, and Jonah chapter 3 and verse 2. I believe that gives us an insight into the basic character of Jonah. I believe that basically Jonah was a lazy person. And whenever God wanted Jonah to do anything, he had to wake him up. Jonah, rise, Jonah, rise, Jonah, rise. Kind of like the lady who came to her helper one day and she said, "Lena, don't you do anything fast?" She said, "Yes, ma'am, I got tired fast." Well, that was Jonah's problem. He got tired fast. Now, I heard Dr. Bob Jones Sr. say this so many times. Whenever a person gets saved, his basic character doesn't change. For instance, if a person is a lazy good-for-nothing and he'd rather live on welfare than get a job, after he gets saved, he'll probably still be a lazy good-for-nothing. If a woman is a sloppy housekeeper before she gets saved, excuse me, after she gets saved, she'll probably still be a sloppy housekeeper. Why? Because we are told that at the age of 4, 50% of the character of your child is instilled into that child by the age of 4. At the age of 6, 75% of the character of the child is instilled into that child. You show me a willful, rebellious 6-year-old. 10 years later, I'm going to show you a willful, rebellious 16-year-old. You see, It behooves every person who is a parent to take some time to instill character into our children. The public school, the media, everything is out to shape their attitude toward life. And so we as parents need to take the time to instill character. I have a music evangelist been traveling with me for 40 years this May. In May will be his last meeting with me. But Larry Brubaker, when he was 11 years old, his daddy, who had been a bartender, was saved. And his daddy, after he got saved, he said, "Larry, I want you to serve God with your life." So he made Larry take piano lessons. Now, Larry can play numerous instruments, and they were all derived from his piano lessons. His dad said, "Son, if you're used of God, it's going to be largely determined by how I take the time to instill character into you." So in 1976, when God wanted somebody to travel with Ron Comfort, he could reach down and say, "Larry Brubaker's dad has taken the time to instill character into him." God uses people who are busy. You'll find this in the New Testament: God never uses a lazy good-for-nothing. Now, on the other hand, he looked down and he saw Saul of Tarsus and he said, "There's a man who's busy doing the wrong thing." He said, "I'll just change his direction and rechannel his vitality." The principle is, God may get a hold of a person who is busy doing the wrong thing, but he won't use a person who isn't doing anything. I was in Alaska in 1991, and an 84-year-old woman got up and played her violin, and she sang. You know what I thought? I thought, how many 84-year-old basketball players do you know? Now think of that. About 10 years ago, I did a stupid thing. My sons-in-law had me out on the basketball court. And the ball would be going out of bounds, and my mind would say, "Get that ball!" And my body would say, "You ain't going to get that ball." You see, here's what I'm saying. We're so insistent that our kids do things that they can only use a short part of their life. But if you get your kids involved in music, they can do that until God takes them home. So God uses people who are busy. God said to Jonah, Jonah, there's the city of Nineveh. The city of Nineveh reached about 60 miles in its perimeter. We could compare it to the city of Washington, D.C. It had a population upward toward 1 million people. And God said, now, Jonah, you can capture that city for me. You were aware that Jonah was a Jew. The Ninevites were Gentiles. His skin was a little different shade than the Ninevites. And God said, Jonah, this way. Jonah said, God, this way. Now, the bulk of our message will be taken from Jonah chapter 1, verses 3 through 6. Will you notice, please, Jonah chapter 1, verses 3 through 6. It says, but Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And he went down to Joppa, and he found the ship going to Tarshish, so he paid the fare thereof. And he went down into it to go with them unto Tarshish, again underline it, from the presence of the Lord. But the Lord sent out a great wind in the sea, and there was a mighty tempest in the sea, so that the ship was like to be broken. Then the mariners were afraid and cried, every man unto his own God, and cast forth the wares that were in the ship into the sea to lighten it of them. But Jonah was gone down the sides of the ship, and he lay and was fast asleep. So the shipmaster came unto him and said unto him, what meanest thou, O sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God. If so be that God will think upon us, that we perish not. All right, get it. Jonah. God said, Jonah, this way. Jonah said, God, this way. Twice in our passage, it says he fled from the presence of the Lord. When he fled from the presence of the Lord, he went down to Joppa. He got on a boat, and he paid the fare thereof. Have you ever noticed how many times in Jonah chapters 1 and 2 the adverb down is used? All right, get it. He went down to Joppa. He went down the boat. He went down to the sides of the ship. He lay down on the bed. That's chapter 1. Chapter 2, he went down to the fish's gullet. He went down to the bottom of the mountains. He went down to Sheol. He went down, 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 down. Tonight, this morning, I'm speaking on this subject, going down. When the child of God gets away from God, there is only one direction to go, and that is down, and he will pay. Very simply this morning, three ways that Jonah paid. All right, notice please the difference of verse 3 and verse 4. Verse 3, but Jonah. Verse 4, but the Lord. Don't you get it? Jonah's will was contrary to the will of God. And when that is true, number one, you lose your joy. What did David say in Psalm 51 and verse 12? Lord, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. The first thing you lose when you get away from God, you lose your joy. I want to ask you a question this morning. Are you happy? Are you happy? Hey, here's a statement. A person who is not right with God cannot be happy. All right, number two. A person who is not happy cannot be right with God. Now, here is my pattern that I have observed for 54 years I've been in evangelism. Before I get up to preach, I like to spend an hour alone with God. I don't like to talk to anybody. I just like to seek the mind of God. 10 minutes before the service, I come in and I put on my microphone. And I watch people as they come in. Most of the time when I get in the pulpit, I have 6 or 7 or maybe more messages in my Bible. Ladies and gentlemen, I do not preach sermons. I preach messages, and I try to discern the mind of God as people walk in. And many times, the way that it is in the song service, God directs me to preach what I need to preach for that message. Ladies and gentlemen, when a person is not right with God, they cannot be in the will of God. I can preach 5 minutes in a Christian school, and I can go down the row and I can tell you every kid that's hooked on rock music. I can preach 5 minutes and I can tell you every kid that's a rebel. You say, how can you do that? Isaiah 3 and verse 9, the show of their countenance does witness against them. And ladies and gentlemen, when you're right with God, there's going to be a song in your heart and a smile on your face. And you're going to be able to sing, what a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arms. I have blessed peace with my Lord so near, leaning on the everlasting arms. Psalm 16 verse 11, thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence there is fullness of joy. And at thy right hand there are pleasures forevermore. John 15 verse 11, these things have I spoken unto you that my joy might remain in you and that your joy might be full. John 16 and verse 24, ask and ye shall receive that your joy might be full. 1 Peter 1 and verse 8, in whom having not seen ye love, in whom though now ye see him not, ye rejoice with joy unspeakable and full of glory. Romans 14 and verse 17, but the kingdom of God is not meat and drink, but righteousness and peace and joy in the Holy Ghost. 1 John 1 and verse 4, these things write we unto you that your joy might be full. Are you happy this morning? Hey, for 22 years we pulled a trailer across America to keep our family together. My wife homeschooled our three daughters from kindergarten through the 12th grade. Over a period of 21 years, she is a candidate for the martyr's crown. But anyway, during those 22 years, people would come to me and they'd say, Brother Comfort, I feel so sorry for you. You're on the road 10 and a half, 11 months out of the year, and oh, you live such a sacrificial life. And you know what I'd say? The only reason you need to feel sorry for me is I live in a 40-foot trailer. I have three daughters, a wife, and a girl dog, and we only have one bathroom and not nearly enough mirrors. Hey, have you ever been in a bathroom in an RV? You don't have enough room in that bathroom to change your mind. But I'd go in that bathroom and I'd see electric curling ironers, electric curlers and pantyhose hanging up everywhere and female accoutrements hanging up. You have no idea what it's like. Now, if you have boys, all you got to do is buy them a pair of black shoes and a pair of brown shoes and a pair of tennis shoes and they've got it made. That's all they need. But not girls. Have you ever heard of the colors mauve? Taupe? Periwinkle, now men, those are colors. And they make shoes those colors. And for every pair of shoes that make those colors, they make earrings and a purse to match it. And a man almost has to have an oil well to keep four females in shoes and purses and earrings. Now, do you know for a long time I could not dress like I wanted to dress? I had to put on my clothes in the morning and go by the female tribunal, and they'd have to check over what I would wear. They wouldn't let me wear stripes and plaids together. Now, preacher can, but I couldn't, you see. And so sometimes I'd see them with their backs turned, and I'd put on what I wanted to wear, and I'd go out the trailer door, and I'd say, hallelujah, I'm the head of my home. I'll dress like I want to dress. Have you ever tried waiting on four females to get ready to go someplace at the same time? Now, I've often said in the parable of the marriage feast, when the fellow said, I can't go, I've married a wife. That was not legitimate. But if he'd have said, I married a wife, I'll be a little late, that would have been legitimate. And I think someday I am going to write a book, Life in a Girl's Dormitory. Now, let me be serious with you folks. Do you know, in 54 years I've been in evangelism, I've never gotten up in the morning and looked in the mirror and said, God, I'm so sorry you've called me to be an evangelist. I want you to know that I'm not enduring what I'm doing. Bless God, I am enjoying it. And I am enjoying it as much now at the age of 77 as I did when I was 23 years of age. There is joy in serving God. Now, let me tell you young people something. The peer group says, if you surrender to God, God's going to make you miserable. I'll tell you, it'll make you miserable. It'll be the peer group that'll make you miserable. But there is joy in serving God. Now listen carefully. Why can't the child of God be happy when he gets out of fellowship? Hebrews 12, 5 through 8. But ye have forgotten the exhortation which speaketh unto you as unto children. My son, despise not thou the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when thou art rebuked of him. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. Now if ye endure chastisement, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Wait a minute. That's strong language. I didn't say it. God said it. Now you know what it means? If you are saved and you get away from God, God will chastise you. It is not he might, it is he will. Now, if you can live in sin and have no chastisement in your life, you may have gone through the motions, but you have never really been born again. He chastens those whom he loves. Now, God knows the area of your life and mine to put his finger on to get our attention the quickest. For instance, God may know there's a young man in here this morning whose God is athletics. And God may know the quickest way to get to your heart is to cut off a vital finger on your right hand. You say God wouldn't do that. I was preaching 1986 at Maranatha Baptist Bible College opening semester. And the first night I preached, I made this statement. Maybe there's a young man in here tonight. You didn't come to Maranatha to train to serve God, but you came to play sports. And God knows that sports is the God of your life. I said, maybe God may have to take off a vital finger on your right hand to get your attention. I had no idea what I was saying. The next morning, a young man came into Dr. Cederholm's office, said, Brother Cederholm, look at here, look at here. He said, Brother Comfort was preaching to me last night. He said, I came here for one reason, to play football. He said, last night when I went to work, God cut off a vital finger on my right hand. He said, God's gotten my attention. I was preaching in Okinawa. Pastor got up before his young people and he said, kids, you know what God had to do to get my attention? He said, I loved baseball. I ate, I slept, I breathed baseball. He said, one summer I was playing baseball, hit a line drive single to right field, a frozen rope. He said, I could see out of the corner of my eye that the right field was sloughing. And I knew that I could stretch a single into a triple. He said, I went around first base full speed ahead. When I came to second base, my foot hit the bag, my ankle twisted, and my kneecap went around in back of my knee. He said, when I got to third base, I was on my face and the bone had gum up through the skin of my knee. He said, God got my attention. When I was a student in college, there was a young lady from Charleston, West Virginia, that if the men were polled, they would have said, she's the most beautiful girl on campus. But God knew her body was her God. That summer, she had a tremendous wreck as she went out on a date. Had over 200 stitches put in that beautiful face. Her face was covered with plastic surgery. Her mouth was all drawn over to the side. When she came back to school in the fall of the year, nobody recognized her as the same young lady. Now listen carefully. There are two words in the passage in Hebrews 12. There's the word chastise, and there's the word scourge. We could compare chastise to a spanking. Scourging is much more severe. When Jesus went to Calvary, he was not spanked. He was scourged. What is scourging? I hold in my hand this morning a tract of the story of Becky Vaughn. How many of you know this story? All right, a few of you do. I was preaching in 1986 in Greenville, South Carolina, Faith Baptist Church. After I got through preaching, John Vaughn, the pastor of the church, came up to the pulpit and he said, "Brother Comfort rang my number tonight." He said, "Brenda, his wife, he said, would you come up and stand beside of me?" He said, 65% of her body is burned with third degree burns. He said, "There's my daughter Becky on the front row, 95% of her body burned with third degree burns. In the track that I hold, in the corner you will see a beautiful 2-year-old toddler. That's before the fire. After the fire, Becky is in the center of the track. She has no fingers. Her fingers are scarred, covered nubs. She has no hair on her body. She wears a wig. When my wife would take her to the children's meetings, my wife said, "Honey, I had to be so careful. When I helped her off with her coat, if I were not careful, I would peel her skin off as I helped her off with her coat." John Vaughn said, "In 1978, I was a Jonah running from God." He said, "I put a can of kerosene in the kitchen. My wife working at the stove ignited the kerosene, and the house became a gigantic inferno." He said, "There's my daughter, Becky. For 4 months, she'd lie in a coma in Shriners Hospital, hovering between life and death." He said, "Every time I look at my wife, every time I look at my little daughter," he said, "I've been reminded that I have been scourged of God." Now you listen to me. If God put his hand on my life, that would be chastisement, spanking. But if God put his hand on one of my family, that would be scourging. And I believe the discerning Christian will fear both a chastening and the scourging of God. Number one, he lost his joy. Will you notice, please, number 2, verses 4 and 5, he lost his concern. The tempest was raging. The ship was rocking back and forth with the storm. Every man was on board the deck crying out to his own God, question, where was Jonah? He was in the bottom of the boat, fast asleep. I want to ask you, isn't that a picture of the world and the church today? The world is crying out to their own gods. They're crying out to the gods of sex, liquor, pleasure, drugs, materialism. But where are we? We're in the bottom of the boat, fast asleep. Ephesians 5 and verse 14, "Awake thou that sleepest and arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light." Romans 13, 11 and 12, "And that knowing the time, it's high time to wake out of sleep. For now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness and put on the armor of light." 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 6, "Let us not sleep as do others, but let us watch and be sober." 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 33, "Awake to righteousness and sin not, for some have not the knowledge of God. I speak this to your shame." Now listen carefully, folks. In my 54 years in evangelism, I have never seen a day when alarm was at a greater height. Did you ever think you would live to see the day that a homosexual woman mayor of Houston, Texas, would ask preachers, Baptist preachers, who had mentioned anything about homosexuality in their messages, they had to give their messages to her to check them over? And there was a sense that they may be indicted because they preached against Romans chapter 1 about homosexuality. You listen to me, I believe the day is coming when they may come in these doors and say, "Preacher, if you preach on Romans chapter 1, we will take away your tax-exempt status." That day, ladies and gentlemen, is coming. I've never seen a day when alarm was at a greater height. Are you listening? I've never seen a day when consecration was at a lower depth. I never have. To me, the greatest paradox in the Bible is Matthew 24 and verse 6. And because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. It would seem to me like when iniquity is abounding, the love of many would wax hot. But I want to ask you, is that true today? 60% of the junior high kids of America have never darkened the door of anybody's church. 80% of the high school kids of America have never sat 1 hour in a Sunday school class. 30 million teens in America have never darkened the door of anybody's church. Ladies and gentlemen, we're living in a day when they're crying out to their own gods. But where are we? In the bottom of the boat, fast asleep. I was in Israel 5 years ago for the fifth time. And as I stood at the pinnacle of the temple in Jerusalem, and I looked across the Kidron Valley, there is the largest Jewish cemetery in the world. When Jesus said, whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones, here's what he meant. A patriarch would die. They'd cut a hole in the ground. They'd put his bones in that hole. His children would die. They'd put their bones in that hole. The grandchildren would die. They'd put their bones in that hole. And many of those graves contain the bones of hundreds of people. And Jesus said, whited sepulchres full of dead men's bones. As I stood there, God began to deal with my heart. And here's what he impressed upon me. Ron Comfort, one day you're just going to be a statistic. That's all you're going to be. And folks, we get proud of our accomplishments. But 2 weeks after you and I are put in the ground, nobody's going to miss us but our immediate family. That's all. That's all. And as I stood there, God began to impress upon me, Ron Comfort, the only thing that is important in your life is what you leave spiritually to the next generation. Parent, what are you going to leave spiritually to the next generation? My daddy died at the age of 77. My grandfather died at the age of 77. My brother called me up on his 75th birthday and he said, Ronnie, I think I'm going to live to be 100. 2 years later, he died of bone cancer at the age of 77. My stepmother died at the age of 77. I'm 77 years old. My birthday is in September. If God only gives me the same amount of time that he gave to these relatives, I've just got a few days to do something for God. And folks, it's not worth it to live for making money. I want to say there's a young lady in glory this morning who came to Ambassador Baptist College in the early 90s. And Amy Caldwell said, Brother Comfort, I've come to Ambassador not because I want a career. She said, I want a ministry. She married one of our graduates, John Bixby. They went up to Colorado and had a ministry for a number of years. 5 years ago, Amy Caldwell Bixby, at 38, died of cancer. But I want to say there is a young lady walking the streets of gold this morning saying, thank God I did not waste my life on making money. He lost his joy, lost his concern. Finally, verse 6, he lost his testimony. It says, so the shipmaster came unto him and said unto him, what meanest thou, O sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us, that we perish not. All right, look this way. I want you to get the picture. Here's an unsaved shipmaster rebuking a saved Jonah. He goes down the bottom boat. He says, Jonah, wake up, wake up. What are you doing in the sack? Are you a man of God? You ought to be down on your knees. You ought to be asking God to save our lives. Hey, do you know that everybody on board the boat that day was praying except one person? Jonah, the man of God who had the answer. Every man was on board the deck crying out to his own God. But the man who had the answer was in the bottom of the boat, fast asleep. I want to ask you as I get ready to close this message, what's the most important thing you have in life? You know the most important thing I have in life? My testimony. My testimony. There is not a moment of my waking hours that I am not aware that I am a representative of Jesus Christ. And I do, in the little things I do, I think that reflects upon my testimony. Every book I put on the table, I sign it. I sign it slowly and legibly. Whenever I sign a Bible, I sign it slowly and legibly. Why? It's part of my testimony. When I'm talking to a man and his wife, I don't look at the woman. I look at the man. I don't want anybody to say Ron Comfort is flirtatious when he gets around women. I was coming several years out of a drugstore and lady said, "Excuse me, sir." She said, "You dropped your lottery ticket." Lottery ticket. I looked down, sure enough, there's a lottery ticket. And I said, "Ma'am, that's not my lottery ticket. I don't play that stuff." But I thought about that. What if I picked up that lottery ticket and I became an instant winner of $20 million? You know the problem with that? My picture would be flashed across the newspapers in America. Fundamental Baptist evangelist wins $20 million in the lottery. There's my testimony. There's my testimony. You don't have enough to buy my testimony. In closing, 2 Samuel chapter 14. Absalom, the son of David, comes back to Jerusalem. He has been estranged from his daddy for 3 years. He stays there a couple more years. So now it's been a total of 5 years since he has seen his daddy. So he comes to one of his servants and he said, "Go to Joab, the captain of my father's host, and arrange a meeting with my daddy and me." Said, "I haven't seen him for 5 years. I've got to see him again." So the servant goes. Joab won't listen. He said, "Tell him again. Tell him." He goes the second time. He said, "Listen, we've gone twice. He won't listen." He said, "Let's forget it." He said, "I'm not going to forget it. I'll guarantee you we'll get his attention." He said, "I want you to go out and I want you to light a match to his barley fields." He said, "That'll get his attention." One day Joab looked out. He was engulfed by flames. And that got his attention. He came running to Absalom and he said, "Absalom, why did you burn down my barley fields?" He said, "You listen to me." He said, "Two times kindly and gently we tried to get your attention, but you wouldn't listen. And the only way we could get your attention is to burn down your barley fields." I wonder, is God speaking to somebody in this building? He's tried to get your attention, but you won't listen. Are you going to make God have to burn down your barley fields to get your attention? Here's the most awesome illustration I've ever heard in my life. Dr. Lee Robertson was called to the hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee in the early 70s. There was a young lady by the name of Mrs. Clarence Lohner on a sick bed. Mrs. Lohner was in her mid-20s. Clarence, her husband, was standing beside of the bed. And Dr. Robertson said, "Clarence, do you think this is the chastisement of God?" He said, "You're right, Doc." He said, "You know, we used to be faithful at Highland Park Baptist Church, but we've gotten away from God." And he said, "Doc, whenever my wife gets out of the hospital, we're going to serve God like we used to." 2 days later, Dr. Robertson was called that Mrs. Clarence Lohner, in her mid-20s, was dead. He was asked to preach her funeral. After preaching the funeral, he came out of the cemetery in the hearse with Dr. Robertson. Clarence was weeping. He said, "Oh, Doc, today God's burned down my barley fields." He said, "The dearest thing I have in life is gone." He said, "Clarence, tonight I'm preaching in a rescue mission service." He said, "Would you come with me to that service? It'll get your mind off your grief and your heartache." He said, "I'll be there." That night, Dr. Robertson preached to the drug addicts and the drunkards. When he gave the invitation, one person came forward, Clarence Lohner. He stood before that crowd of derelicts and he said, "Men, today I stood by the grave of my wife." He said, "The dearest thing I have in life is gone." He said, "I'm going to tell you why." He said, "Years ago, God called me to preach." He said, "I've been a Jonah. I've been running from God. But," he said, "I'm here today to tell you, God's called me to preach, and I'm going to preach." After the service, Dr. Robertson came to him and said, "Clarence, are you telling the truth? Has God really called you to preach?" He said, "I know that as clearly as I know anything in life. God's called me to preach, and I'm going to preach." He said, Clarence, would you do me a favor? He said, you know, Wednesday night we have prayer meeting at Highland Park Baptist Church. He said, would you come to the service, and after I preach, would you come forward and give this testimony? He said, I'll be there. Wednesday night came. Dr. Robertson sat on the platform, scanned the crowd. No sign of Clarence Lohner. He thought, well, he's lost in the crowd. He'll make himself known at the invitation. The invitation came and went. Still no sign of Clarence Lohner. All right, listen carefully. The next day, Clarence Lohner drove in front of Highland Park Baptist Church with a girlfriend with which he had been having an affair during the life of his wife. He went around the corner on Orchard Knob, parked in an alleyway, rolled the window down, was talking to his girlfriend. A man put the barrel of a revolver through the window, squeezed the trigger, and blew Clarence Lohner out into eternity. The girlfriend of Clarence Lohner was raped. The next day, Dr. Robertson was called to the funeral home. As he came in the funeral home, here was a casket with the body of Clarence Lohner and his girlfriend sitting right beside of it. After a while, Dr. Robertson began to put two and two together, and he realized this girl had been having an affair with Clarence Lohner even during the life of his wife. When he realized that, he became incensed. And he went over the girl and he said, young lady, do you realize you're partially to blame for this man's body being in a casket, his wife's body being in a graveyard? He said, you had no right having an affair with a married man. And he said, when you stand before God, you'll give an account for that. He said, now tell me, what were Clarence Lohner's last words before his brains were blown out? She said, you want to know what they were? She said, Clarence said, God has called me to preach, but I guess I'm too wicked. I'll never preach. And with that, Clarence Lohner was blown out into eternity. Now listen to the end of the story. Today, Clarence Lohner, Mrs. Lohner's bodies are in a graveyard. The girlfriend of Clarence Lohner that was raped, Dr. Robertson, told me that in 2 months she mysteriously died. 2 months later, the last I heard, the murderer and the rapist was out of jail on parole. I'd never give that story, but what I think, is there a prospective Clarence Lohner in this building this morning? I've wandered far away from God. Now I'm coming home, the paths of sin too long I've trod. Lord, I'm coming home. Jonah, get off that one-way ship of disobedience. Let's bow our heads in prayer.